Kennedys, President Franklin, Delano Roosevelt, addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
How's it going, Higher Side Chatters? Drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke. From sunny San Diego, I'm Greg Carlwood, and I'm really excited about today's show. Robert David Steele was brought to my attention by a listener request, and as soon as I touched base with Robert and he told me his latest book was called Open Source Everything, I knew that it was going to be right up my alley, just the kind of topic I was looking for. It's largely an approach that shoots for all the technological improvements and efficiency of something like the Venus Project without the totalitarian aspects that people seem to get all worried about. And I actually feel more hopeful when I hear about some of these ideas. It's just that we have to get through to people about what the possibilities are, because without that, they don't see the difference between where we are and where we could be. They don't realize how angry they should be and how progress is actually being halted by the old guard. But it's a really great, positive topic for one of the last shows of the year. So let's get down to it. Open source everything, building the world brain and concepts for full spectrum optimization to replace our corrupt, wasteful, and decaying top-down structure that we've yet to wiggle out from underneath of with Robert David Steele. Boom. All right, folks, most of us recognize that nearly every aspect of modern society is in shambles, decaying right before our eyes, whether it be the education system, which is ironically one of the biggest obstacles to a free-thinking, enlightened youth, or our thinly veiled economy, which funnels our good fortunes to the powerful puppet masters and leaves us with a nice green shackle of debt clasped firmly around our collective necks like a helpless Princess Leia in the clutches of Jabba the Bankster. Well, today's guest, Robert David Steele, might just turn out to be our own personal Han Solo. He grew up all over the world as a son of an oil engineer, witnessing colonialism and predatory capitalism up close and personal. He's been a Marine Corps infantry officer, a CIA spy, and even had a brief presidential campaign in 2012 with the Reform Party. He also holds the prestigious accomplishment of being the most published intelligence reformer in the English language, with 9 books and many more writings on the subject. A man who's been an insider and served the system, yet has emerged like a white knight from the deep, dark belly of the beast to become the CEO of Open Source Solutions and a voice for what could and should be the next evolution of human society, the blueprint of which is largely laid out in his book, The Open Source Everything Manifesto, Transparency, Truth, and Trust. And as much as I like holding a magnifying glass to the broken system and the crimes of the power pyramid, I like exciting new possibilities even more. So let's get this party started. Robert David Steele, welcome to THC.
Great introduction. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks, man. I try to get the people jazzed up, and today with good cause. I'm very happy that you are willing to come on the show. Thanks so much for that. There is a lot we could talk about, and I really did love your book. I think you are right on with the open source idea, and I'm pretty sure a lot of people have probably heard the term open source or might be familiar with it in the context of software. But how would you introduce this to someone who might not have a totally clear understanding of this idea right out of the gate?
Well, I'm glad you give me that opportunity, because most people understand open source as having to do with software. And there are giants out there like RMS and Linux Torvalds. Richard Stallman is RMS. But I like to talk about an open source ecology. And what that really means is that open source is a mindset, it's a culture, it's a way of doing business. And so it doesn't just apply to software, although if you take the information arena, I just wrote something that seems to have been popular in some circles on the next data revolution. Open source in relation to data includes OpenBTS, or Open Base Transceiver Station, which is code for free cell phones, open cloud, open data, open government, open hardware and software, of course, but then open standards and open spectrum. And so across the board, if you don't have all of the opens, then your one single open is going to suffocate. It won't scale. It won't be affordable. It won't be interoperable, and it won't scale. So people who talk about open government or open data without actually respecting the need for all the other opens are, in fact, running a scam. Mm-hmm. Because those are not real. Open government without all the other opens is not really open. Open data without open software and open hardware is simply a handout to proprietary vendors like ESRI. Beyond that, you have open technologies in farming, in business. You have open money. You have something that's near and dear to my heart, open carry, which is a Second Amendment constitutional right of every citizen. So across the board, open can apply to anything. And it's really a conflict between, or not a conflict, but a contrast between rule by secrecy, which Jim Mars has written a very good book about, and open source everything. We are the antidote to everything that's gone wrong in the last 50 years.
I love it. I think that's a great introduction. It seems like a very efficient way to do things, but you're right. It does have to be kind of a multifaceted all or nothing approach, or it won't work. And that's one of the hardest things to implement, wouldn't you say?
Well, yes and no. One of the things that I've noticed these last few years, I've been mentored by people like Tom Attlee, who lives in a commune. He wrote The Tao of Democracy, and he's written several other books, including Evolutionary Activism and a new book on public wisdom. In fact, what we're doing is redefining prosperity back to the original natural condition. There's a wonderful book, 1491, which points out that the average Mayan male only had to work 60 days a year in order to comfortably support a family of five. And what has happened in the industrial era is we've essentially enclosed the commons. We've criminalized private behavior in relation to the natural world. And we have made it possible to concentrate wealth for the few at the expense of the many. When you really look at how humanity can interact with nature and what is a proper definition of prosperity, it turns out that not only is peace vastly more profitable for everybody, but it's more prosperous to be open. Alvin Toffler first brought this concept up in Power Shift. He talked about how information shared acquires additional value with every sharing. That's not the attitude of governments and corporations. They want a stovepipe. They're living by a Germanic, Weberian, cubbyhole, hoarding mentality. And what that really means is they're depriving everybody by trying to hoard stuff for profit. The real profit is being a good steward of the earth and having a good life with minimal labor.
Yeah, it sounds so great. It's a shame that we haven't had a chance to really make those kind of strides towards that kind of system.
Well, I would say that we did, in fact, prior to 1491, when Columbus brought disease and gunpowder to the Americas, he also brought a European mindset. There's an excellent book called Voltaire's Bastards by John Salston Rowell. There's another one by Lionel Tiger called The Manufacture of Evil. There's a third one by, I think it's Peter Thiel, called Stop Thief. Essentially, the West triumphed over the nature and the tribes by force of arms, not by force of thought. And one of the things that I really admire about an emergent literature, there's an excellent book called Health of Nations, Society and Law Beyond the State. And what it points out is that most of the borders today that are being fought over are borders that were imposed at the point of a gun. They're artificial colonial borders. And as a result, what the colonies did was they created this massive Western industrial era that created great wealth for the few, but it essentially cut everybody off from subsistence living. It cut them off from the ability to get by without having to be a wage slave. It cut them off from their villages and their families. It cut them off from respect for nature. True cost economics is one of my pet rocks these days. And the reality is people have no idea the larger price that is not only being paid today, but that will be paid by future generations. In fact, I was just looking at a study. A McDonald's hamburger actually costs $250 when you add up all of the water, the fuels, the toxins, the child labor, and the health costs of obesity if you allow supersize me to take over your life. So McDonald's is a failing corporation, as it should be. Coca-Cola and Nestle should be failing corporations. Monsanto should have been put to death years ago. So once you start reconnecting to nature and you start reconnecting to common sense and you start reconnecting to the actual true cost of many of these offerings, all of a sudden life gets much better and at no additional cost. In fact, you end up saving huge amounts of money.
Mm. Well said. Yeah, those are great points. There are just so many costs other than financial, and we're just kind of bred to all we really think about is that financial cost. And as far as the open source idea, one area I wanted to ask you about where it would apply to the current news cycle is this whole debacle over this Sony hack in the movie The Interview. They're afraid to release it into theaters for the threat of an attack on the crowd. But if you just released the movie open on the internet and allowed it to spread instead of having the tightly controlled distribution channel that the corporation wants of sitting duck targets, then there wouldn't be much anyone could do to stop it, is there?
I completely agree with you. And in fact, I completely agree with Obama for the first time in 8 years. he has said that Sony has made a mistake, and I agree with that. I believe that all voices must be heard, and I think it's a serious mistake to try and repress information, and particularly if you think that the information is offensive or incorrect. If it's offensive or incorrect, it should be put out there to be destroyed by the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. And I know you do know a lot about hacking and computer technology. Do you think we're getting the real story on this situation of the hack with Sony?
I honestly don't know. I haven't paid attention to it. But I will point out to you that all of the alarms that are being sounded today are identical to the alarms that were sounded by Wynn Schwartau and myself and several others when Wynn published his books, Terminal Compromise and Information Warfare, Chaos on the Electronic Superhighway. All of this stuff we warned about in 1988 through 1992. There were Air War College papers on the vulnerabilities of our financial and communications and energy systems. All of the information was out there. And the U.S. government very irresponsibly refused to listen. Corporations very irresponsibly refused to put their SCADA systems, their supervisory control and administration systems. They refused to put them off the internet in secure, isolated form. So everything that's happening today is after ignoring 25 years of warning. So in my view, the hell with everybody that refused to listen.
Yeah, it's got to be frustrating to have been sounding the alarm for so long and just gotten no response.
Well, you know, it is frustrating. In fact, I've recently called for the firing of Jim Clapper and Mike Vickers and John Brennan. And for those that don't know, Clapper is the Director of National Intelligence, who was the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. Vickers is the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. And John Brennan, who was a fine case officer in his time, is the Director of CIA. They've all lost their moral compass. They have wasted $1.25 trillion in the 25 years since I published the ghostwritten paper for General Al Gray and then my own paper on the six things that needed to be done in order to make national intelligence useful to decision making, not just for national security, but for agriculture, water, and so forth. We would not be dealing with fracking today if the national intelligence community of the United States of America were an honest, competent national intelligence community. This community is so dishonest at the top. They actually recommend fracking as a solution for our national energy shortfall in a report called Global Trends 2030. They recommend fracking, which causes earthquakes and contaminates aquifers. At the same time that Governor Cuomo in New York has just forbidden fracking for the best of reasons.
Yeah, fracking is one of those cases where it's pretty easy to see through the lies there, but there is just so many different areas of manipulation and propaganda and getting in the way of corporate profits, and it's so hazy to really get down to the truth. It's hard to even imagine what an open information society could even do for us. It's like the ramifications would just be completely mind-boggling.
Well, you know, I'm it's funny because I remember this Crocodile Dundee movie where there was some discussion about a guy having a problem, and Crocodile Dundee has some line about how, hey, this is no problem. You just tell everybody about it and the problem goes away. In fact, what open source does is it makes everybody part of the solution. I love the line that the Linux guys use: put enough eyeballs on it, no bug is invisible. I would say that 90% of our problems in the world today are caused by secrecy and corruption that is enabled by secrecy. Every problem that Wall Street has caused has been a problem caused by secrecy and corruption, by legalized crime. It's an utter outrage that Iceland was the only country with the balls and the brains to renounce the illegal debt, to put its bankers in jail, to punish its politicians that sold out the public interest. And today, Iceland has just paid off the International Monetary Fund years ahead of time, and it's got a better economic rating than the United States of America.
You're so right, man. And that was another huge no-brainer where I really don't even think they did a good job of fooling average people. I think it was a pretty obvious theft, but there's just such a disconnect between the citizens and this rogue government that we really just don't get much of a say in the matter.
Well, that's why I recently published the Electoral Reform Act of 2015. When I ran briefly for president, it was mostly to get all the good ideas on the table and to reach out to the other presidential candidates, all of whom I found were not serious. There wasn't a single presidential candidate among the small parties that was willing to commit to an electoral reform summit. Every single one of them was focused on me, 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 okay? Very selfish, narrow interests. I believe that we are paying the price for turning democracy over to the most corrupt legislature in modern history. The U.S. Congress doesn't even read the laws that it passes. These are laws written by lobbyists. It doesn't even read them. The Patriot Act, for example. It passes laws written by lobbyists without reading them. And our citizens let them get away with it. So we have the democracy that we deserve.
I mean, that's true. I do think we have a responsibility to take back our government, especially if it's killing people overseas in our name, on top of all the other reasons. But you mentioned your presidential campaign, and I did want to ask you a little bit about that because it had to be pretty insightful into the process. You know, they still have a lot of people fooled into thinking it's Republican versus Democrat, but in reality, it's Republican and Democrat versus everyone else because there are multiple other parties that have real solid organizations and plenty of support, but they get boxed out, and the Republicans and Democrats very much act united in circling those wagons and eliminating other voices from being heard. And I'm sure you experienced that to some degree, didn't you?
I'm really thrilled that you bring that up because although I'm a very educated person with two graduate degrees in the Naval War College behind me, I had to run for president in order to learn that there are 8 accredited political parties in the United States. And that basically means that a party has won 5% of the vote at some point in time and therefore is considered a national party. Those parties, and I'll list them because I'm stunned that I did not know this, and I hope others will learn from this. Those parties are the Constitution Party, which is a Christian whitish kind of party, which goes back to the roots of the founders. The Green Party, the Libertarian Party, the Natural Law Party, which is moribund, the Reform Party, for which I was a candidate for the nomination, and the Socialist Party, which is also moribund. There are also 2 really important, excellent parties that are rising in the wings. One of them is the Working Families Party that Bill de Blasio in New York represents. And the other is the Justice Party that Rocky Anderson tried to raise up in the West with some limited success. None of these parties have ballot access. And this is where I part ways with Lawrence Lessig, whom I admire very much for what he's done with Creative Commons and many other of his works. It doesn't matter if you take the money out of politics if you still don't have access to the ballot. So I have published today, and it's easy to find if you look up Electoral Reform Act of 2015, you'll find a graphic that lists 8 very specific things that we need to do in order to restore integrity to the electoral process in the United States. And I like to say there's nothing wrong with America the Beautiful that cannot be fixed and fixed fairly quickly if we simply restore integrity to the electoral process and therefore to the government. Everything else falls into place.
I'm with you on that, man. And maybe we could talk about a couple of those principles. I'm sure that one of them would be not letting a private company be in charge of our national voting machines.
Well, Diebold is a very corrupt company, and it's a very unprofessional company. Its machines are easily hackable. Its president has boasted publicly about being able to deliver whatever vote you want. I mean, these people are the epitome of dishonesty. And the fact that they're hired by governors is a reflection on the dishonesty of the governors hiring them. Among the eight provisions for the Electoral Reform Act of 2015 are paper ballots counted on the spot, in publicly, of course. No electronic machine should be allowed to count votes.
Yeah, I do agree with you that that would be a system that's worked in the past and much better than what we have. But I don't see why we can't just vote on the internet if it's secure enough for all the other things we do on it. I would like to see a system like Reddit where we can just all see the things that our representatives would see, and then we can just vote up or down. And I'm sure eventually we would find an equilibrium point on a lot of issues.
Well, it's not only voting up or down, because there's some nuances that can be accommodated. For instance, an instant runoff. One of the problems that third parties have, let's say that third parties can get access to the ballot, which they certainly should. And that what that means is that the qualifications for gaining access to the ballot must be identical at the state and local levels, instead of having skewed heavy requirements that are levied on small parties to keep them out. And at the federal level, all nationally accredited parties should have their candidates on all ballots for federal office. That should be mandated. That's a law that has been introduced at the congressional level 9 times, the last 4 times by Ron Paul. I give him great credit on that. And the fact is, the two-party tyranny does not want to share power, because they like being able to loot the purse for their 5% kickback. But instant runoff is a way of addressing the concerns that people have, because if they vote for a third party candidate and that candidate loses, then they might have thrown the vote to the worst of the lesser evils. So instant runoff allows you to vote for 2 or 3 candidates. And if your candidate doesn't win, then your vote shifts to your second choice and third choice and so forth. And that is a much fairer way of electing people than the system that we have right now.
Absolutely. That's a great idea. I really like that.
Let me just jump in and say none of these ideas are original to me. One of the things that I do is I harvest good ideas from other people. And when I ran for president for 6 weeks, I did it in part to harvest all the best ideas, and I've put them all up at a website called We the People Reform Coalition. The URL is bigbatusa.org, and you'll remember Joe Trippi's Big Bat for Howard Dean, so bigbatusa.org. And all of these ideas that I've pulled together, my gift is to pull together the best ideas from others, but these are all ideas that have been tried and tested by others, and I've simply gone out and harvested them.
That's very fair. You're a living example of the open source principle. I wanted to ask you a little bit about Google, because I've heard you talk about them in the past, and a lot of people think of them as one of the good guys, but behind the scenes, they're really not so innocent, are they?
Well, first off, Google was formed by at least one great crime, one mistake, and one government secret intervention. The great crime is that Google stole Yahoo's search engine, and that was the beginning of Google. The great mistake was HP's killing autonomy, and all of those wonderfully good people then went to work for Google. And the secret intervention was CIA funding Google. So those three things came together, and in essence, I regard Google as nothing more than a light version of NSA.
See, that's interesting, and I don't disagree with you, but on the scale of corporations, I think most people find them to be one of the best and associate them with being their dog in the fight for free and open internet, which of course they'd have their own motivations for, and I'm sure that perception is just the corporate spin and the hardworking PR team they have.
Well, it's also nonsense. I mean, I know Larry Pryor personally. We're both members of the Silicon Valley Hackers Conference, which is an elected body. And I like Larry. He's a wonderful engineer, but he doesn't get it. He's all about algorithms, and he doesn't understand sense making, and he doesn't understand the public interest. And what he's done is he's fallen prey to the venture capitalists and the people that want to use Google as a steamroller rather than as a liberation technology. Google, by its own admission, indexes less than 4% of the digital web. And I personally think it's less than 2%. And Google, by its own admission, will give out search results that are what somebody else has paid for you to see rather than the best-in-class search results. So at multiple levels, I consider Google dishonest, and I'm really looking forward to an open-source Google killer. And by the way, DuckDuckGo is doing very, very well against Google.
Interesting. So, yeah, on the subject of what Google filters out, because I think that might be pretty shocking to some people, but yet we do hear the terms deep web and dark net, and some people say they're the same, some think they're different. What can you tell us about this kind of mysterious undernet?
Well, first off, let me start with the innocence of it all, and let me define the terms. The shallow web is what Google indexes, and Bing and Yahoo, Baidu. You know, Yahoo got $1 billion as a quitclaim penalty from Google, but the damage was done. Yahoo was mortally wounded. But Baidu and whatever the Russian search engine is, all of these people have potential, but they're all not thinking clearly. But the shallow web is what a standard search engine will index. The deep web is legitimately available information that's on the web if you know where to look. And then the dark web is information, generally criminal, that has been very deliberately hidden behind encryption and various forms of obscurity, including steganography, which is hiding information inside of a photo. Now, let me just draw an example. A standard nonprofit, a standard activist organization will have two kinds of information on the web. They'll have full text information. That's the stuff that's easy to index, and that's the low-hanging fruit that Google has. They will also publish thousands and thousands of PDF documents that are nice, slick, glossy documents with beautiful color copies and tables of contents and so forth. And they'll not only bury those documents without a persistent URL, but those documents aren't properly indexed. So the deep web consists of everything below the shallow web that is legitimately openly available, but you have to go look for it and you have to hand harvest it. Now, there are companies like Abe Letterman's Deep Web Technologies, which do an absolutely phenomenal job of scraping the web. And they will go out, for example, I paid money in 2007 to scrape the top poverty sites on the planet. And so we were able to get, if I had to guess, I'd say 80% of the information instead of 4%, which is what Google gets. We were able to get 80% of the useful information from all those webs because we went in and we basically copied every single thing they had that was visible, and then we indexed it all, and that gave us a superior index to what the web owners themselves had.
Wow, man. So it is definitely doable, but wow, that is a huge increase in information, up to 80%. Man, so another area I really wanted to ask you about was copyrights and patents in an open society, because this is what critics tend to bring up. But let me also say that the security and laws and regulations like that is an illusion anyway, because it's pretty much common knowledge that Microsoft, Facebook, Apple, and as you just pointed out now, Google, as well as I'm sure many others at the top, these companies all have theft in their origins. So maybe critics should go back and rethink the notion that our ideas are even safe now.
That's a good point. I mean, there is a viable justification for patents and trademarks, and my personal rule is use it or lose it. One of the problems we have in the United States is that really excellent technologies for low cost, efficient energy, indestructible paints, all kinds of things that would have saved trillions of dollars over the last 50 years. These have been patented and locked up. In some cases, their inventors have been murdered in order to protect legacy systems. And one of the problems that we have is concentrated wealth that uses secrecy to conceal great crimes. I personally think that it's insane to have central banking, and it's insane to have banks that are allowed to create money out of nothing and then charge interest they don't deserve and then ruin economies just because they can. So this whole openness thing is in fact a way of healing society and healing the economy. And I will also point out that proprietary technologies, let's take Oracle, for example, or IBM or Microsoft. Proprietary technologies are unaffordable, they are not interoperable, and they do not scale. We are retarded in the analysis arena, which is to say the analytic scrutiny of all forms of information in order to arrive at decision support and smart conclusions. We are retarded because Microsoft and Oracle and IBM have never cared about making sense. They've only cared about selling software licensing fees and maintenance fees and training fees and moving bits and bytes. They've never cared about actually making sense about anything.
Mm-hmm. You're right on, man. Everything you say, I'm in such agreement with. I mean, you make a great point, too, about being murdered for copyrights. That was one of the prevailing theories about the Malaysian flight, is that it was a hit on some patent holders somewhere along the line.
I honestly don't know, but I do believe that the Malaysian flight was hijacked electronically. And if it did not land at Diego Garcia, I think it crashed somewhere on the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so tough to know. If we had that open society, it wouldn't be such a mystery.
Well, let me give a lot of credit to the tail watchers, because the CIA rendition flights were discovered by people watching tail numbers.
Hmm.
Those CIA rendition flights would never have been discovered if we hadn't had cognitive surplus out there looking at tail numbers. And one of the things that I think is starting to happen is that governments and police and others are starting to be accountable in a way that they've never had to deal with before. We now have citizens armed with handheld devices that take photos. We now have internet capabilities, many of which cannot be shut down. I'm the author of the Autonomous Internet Roadmap, which is at the Peer-to-Peer Foundation. And I believe the day is coming. I just published a new piece on the coming data revolution. I believe the day is coming when we will have a distributed internet in which all of the data is held on our individual handheld devices, and we put the cloud and intermediate servers out of business.
Wow. That seems kind of tough to visualize.
Well, let me point you to SharkNet in Germany. They're building it.
Interesting. Well, tell us about SharkNet a little bit.
No, I can't tell you about SharkNet, but I want you to go look it up.
Okay. Well, you know, in the book, you do talk about the evolution of Web 2.0 a little bit, and that you'd like to see this jump to the Web 4.0 world brain. Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, there's multiple aspects of creating a proper world brain. I mean, one of them is to have an autonomous internet that cannot be censored and cannot be shut down. That for me is the first priority. The second is to put all education on the internet and combine that with call centers and harnessing the diaspora. Dr. Patrick Meir in Humanitarian Technologies and Crisis Mappers have done some incredible things. And I'm infuriated every time I see a Washington-based think tank such as the U.S. Institute of Peace or the New America Foundation claim to have reinvented the wheel when it's actually been going for the last 10 years under Dr. Meir. There are a lot of people in Washington willing to take credit for stuff they didn't invent, and they're using it simply to gain funding that will feather their salaries rather than actually help people in the Philippines, which is what Meir does. So step one is an autonomous internet that cannot be censored. Step two is the ability of everyone to learn anything they need to learn through the internet or through a cell phone call. Step three is the creation of a global standard for identifying true costs. One of the things we need to do is use the internet to move markets. And by that, I mean, I've designed this little handheld app that shows you red, yellow, and green circles for any given product based on its barcode. And it tells you how much virtual water there's in there, how much fuel, how many toxins, how much child labor, whether the company making it is guilty of tax avoidance, and so forth. So in an instant, just by looking at the barcode, you can say, oh, evil incarnate. Now, the problem is any fool can design an app on a cell phone that shows nicely to a venture capitalist. The hard part is actually creating the database and documenting the true costs of every product and service. I mean, for example, beef, there's some wonderful films, The Secret Life of Beef and so forth. It takes 5,000 gallons of water to put a pound of beef on the table. It takes 20 gallons of water to put a pound of tomatoes on the table. Most people don't know that. Most people have no idea what the true cost is of anything. Your smartphone puts 10 Chinese people into a leukemia ward because it's built using a class A carcinogenic benzene, which is only legal in China.
Wow. Yeah, I know about the Foxconn nets on the buildings of some of these factories, but I had not heard that. I know they're using borderline slave labor to mine out these minerals themselves, but it's all hidden behind the veil of secrecy. And meanwhile, Apple gets a pass for being some great capitalist benchmark.
And that is just a sign of how ignorant we have become. Our public education system has not kept up with reality. I'm deeply troubled by the mediocrity of our public education system. And I'm deeply troubled by the fact that the Koch brothers are going around buying university departments in order to instill libertarian economics, which is a form of fascism, corporate ownership and control. I'm deeply concerned by the Koch brothers buying up secondary school history books and trying to eradicate civil disobedience from all history books across the United States of America. This kind of insanity is in my own mind grounds for revolution, but apparently nobody's noticing.
Yeah, that's true. It is sad. I sometimes wonder how far people really have to be pushed for something to happen.
I don't know the answer to that, but I will tell you that there's a difference between preconditions of revolution and precipitants of revolution. And I have, in fact, published, if your listeners will go to graphic preconditions of revolution, they will find that I have published a chart of all of the preconditions of revolution, and I have colored in red the preconditions of revolution that exist in the United States of America. And the three most important are concentration of wealth, loss of faith in the government, and unemployed people with college degrees.
Well, you would think we were there then, because check, check, and check.
Yeah, really.
But yes, I did see that piece, and I was very interested in that, because we talk about the state of revolution all the time, and there are some people who might argue that if you look at the police brutality protests going on all over, and the big one in New York specifically, some might say that we are in the middle of it.
No, we're not. That's all. Look at Occupy. Occupy was a complete failure.
Right.
It had one stunning moment during which it could have demanded the Electoral Reform Act of 2012. We could have elected Ron Paul and Denis Kucinich in a coalition cabinet. But Ron Paul essentially, I don't want to use the word sold out, but he has been a member of the controlled opposition. He has kept the Libertarian Party quiet and out of the way. And I don't know what's going to happen with Ron Paul and Rand Paul, but I do believe that the Libertarian Party needs to look deeply into its soul and break completely with the Republican Party.
Amen, man. Yes, before we can even figure out what works, we have to all agree that these two parties don't, and they both need to be completely abandoned. And I look back on it now, it's hard to believe I even voted for Obama originally, but I was so into the spirit of a hip young dude getting the old boys out and hope and change, and then there was this huge disappointment, of course. And I got really hopeful for Occupy, as it was the first time there'd ever been widespread protests in my lifetime, and then that faded away. It's easy to become cynical now and feel a bit hopeless these days, you know?
Well, let me give you a success story. When the governor of New York outlawed fracking, everybody from the New York Times to Mother Jones completely missed the real story. The real story is that one single couple, both of them lawyers, went village by village across New York State, educating them on fracking and getting them to pass a local ordinance against fracking. And this drove the industry mad. They finally took it to the appeals court of New York, and God bless the appeals court, they upheld the sanctity of the village ordinances. And that is what led Cuomo to forbid fracking, not any great judgment on his part. So Mother Jones, New York Times missed it completely. The other half of the story that they missed is that the director of national intelligence, in a document published by the National Intelligence Council called Global Trends 2030, explicitly says in black and white that fracking is part of the energy solution for the future of the United States of America. If I were president, I would fire him immediately for being stupid on the job.
Hear, hear. And yeah, that is a pretty positive example of a small victory against these guys, but they are so persistent. And as terrible as fracking is, I'm kind of curious about energy as a whole and what really could be accomplished with a full open source approach. Can you give us any more insight into how different it really could be?
Well, I think we're very close to free energy. I think we're extremely close, and it may happen first in Latin America. There are three parts to energy. The first is creating the energy. The second is storing the energy. And the third is reducing the amount of energy needed. So in energy creation, solar is now well beyond fossil fuels in terms of price point and return on investment. And one of the things most people don't realize is that fossil fuels persist in part because our corrupt Congress is subsidizing the fossil fuel industry. Keystone Project is an atrocity against humanity. It should absolutely not be allowed. The Canadian government's plans to flush tar sands in Alberta and try and ship them out across Quebec is an atrocity. And I certainly hope that Quebec absolutely refuses to collaborate with that because it's a crime against humanity. So renewable energy is there. Solar energy, wind energy, geothermal energy, it's all there. And if we were to eliminate the subsidies that we now give the fossil fuel industry, to include tax breaks and overlooking their heinous tax avoidance, then fossil fuels would be dead within 10 years. The second part is battery storage. And one of the challenges that we've faced over many years is that we lose 50% of the energy from its centralized point of production, whether it's a hydroelectric dam or an oil field or whatever. We lose 50% of the energy. Well, energy batteries now are making huge leaps in efficiency. And I believe that we're getting to the point now where we're going to be able to store and retain energy 3 to 5 times more efficiently than we have in the past. So that's the second major revolution that's happening. The third major revolution is in terms of displacing uses of energy that were in the past essential. And the big revolution that's happening there is in the cooling arena. There are now a couple of innovations, including one using infrared lighting and the other one I can't remember, but they essentially eliminate the need for geothermal cooling or for, you know, traditional energy as a coolant. They create cooling without energy, if you will. So I'm absolutely confident that we're moving very quickly toward free energy. And once you get free energy, among the many things that allows you to do is desalinate salt water and decontaminate inland water. And that changes everything.
Yeah, water is another area where there's a ridiculous battle going on. And Nestle's CEO said water should be completely privatized rather than thought of as a human right or just part of the earth, which sounds so slimy and creepy to even say. But we got to be careful because they can easily get their way.
Well, the Nestle CEO is an idiot, and he's a corrupt idiot. In fact, water is a human right and it's part of nature. And again, I would send people to my book. Whenever I mention a book, I've written a summary review of it on Amazon. I'm the number one Amazon reviewer for nonfiction. I read 98 categories. Amazon's trying to push the old guys out. So a lot of times you have to go back and look for my review in an earlier edition. But I've reviewed a book called Stop Thief. And it talks about how we have essentially criminalized what used to be natural human rights in relation to nature. I personally think that Nestle and Coca-Cola should not be allowed to pull any more clean water out of the earth. I think they should be required to build their own water desalination plants.
Amen. And going back to the energy thing, the energy conversation is fascinating, and I love hearing about the advancements. And the tech might be there, but how do we really get past the corporate gatekeepers? A lot of people don't even know what's even possible.
Well, that's true. And again, I come back to electoral reform. I mean, I've had some interesting conversations in the last few weeks, including a Green Party group that asked me to run for their nomination in 2016. And the point that I've made to people, everyone wants to fight fracking or they want to get the truth on 9/11 or whatever. And what I'm telling people is none of these battles are winnable. The only battle that is winnable and the only battle that counts is the battle for electoral reform. We can, on the 1st of March, we could have an electoral reform summit with Ron Paul, Dennis Kucinich, Jesse Ventura, Ralph Nader, Cynthia McKinney, Rocky Anderson, Gary Johnson, Jill Stein, myself, and a few others. We could issue a demand, a statement of demand to Congress, we could then occupy the front lawns and the home offices of every governor, senator, and representative. And we could tell them very candidly, you have 30 days in which to pass the Electoral Reform Act of 2015. And if they don't, we put them all out of office in 2016.
Amen.
This is doable. Look, this is doable. People really seriously underestimate the power of people.
That is true. And, you know, that's a bit by design. We're just kind of led to believe we don't have any power.
That's true. And in fact, the whole system is designed to entertain you into apathy. And it's a truly sad, sad thing. Now, there is, I think, some good news. I mean, on the one hand, I think the average American is much smarter and much more attentive to the possibilities than people realize. And there's a wonderful book by that title, The Average American, which I strongly recommend. And at the same time, there's a book on cultural creatives by Paul Ray and Sherry Ruth Anderson. They're a couple. And their original estimate was that there were 50 million people in the United States that were actually conscious. I think the number is closer to 100 million. Now, imagine 100 million people each giving $10 a year for a freedom fund. That's $1 billion. I absolutely guarantee you that if I had influence over $1 billion and I had an electoral reform summit on the 1st of March, I would clean this government up by 2016.
Yeah, wow. It doesn't take much. All those microtransactions. I mean, that's how we get by here.
Well, the microtransactions, you're actually leading into my tax reform plan, which is something I've adopted from Edward Fagee in Chicago, and that's the automated payment transaction tax, which is it's electoral reform item number 7. We need to end all taxes. We need to end all income taxes in particular. The current revenue system is a criminal enterprise. The reason the tax code is so complicated is because that's how congressmen create toll gates. That's how congressmen blackmail their business constituencies into donating to their political action campaigns. They say, oh, well, we're going to create this tax, but if you want an exemption, you know what you need to do. The automated payment transaction tax is an utterly brilliant idea that applies to every transaction, including all of the transactions that are not taxed now. For example, every currency and stock transaction on Wall Street would be taxed, and it would be a 0.000006 kind of tax. Okay? So what that does is it explodes the revenue pie. But there's another side benefit, which is the APT tax rate is set by the public, which means that we can set a rate that cuts the government in half, and we can also set a rate that makes wars unaffordable unless we approve a tax increase.
Real control over our own government. What a novel idea.
Well, there's a lot of good ideas, and that's why I ran for president in 2012. And if people come together and decide I could be useful in 2016, I will. Of course, I'm not Jim Webb, but I'm certainly better than Hillary Clinton or Jeb Bush. And I would like to have this voice, not necessarily my voice, but this coalition voice. I would like to see the leaders of the small parties get their act together and run as a team rather than in isolation from one another.
And I love that approach, that you are really just, you know, an embodiment of something larger. And that's something that our government is supposed to be doing. I mean, it clearly says representatives. You're supposed to be representing your community. It's just that we can't fit everybody into the building. But yet, that idea is gone.
Well, it's even worse. It's worse than that. I mean, there are studies now that clearly document that congressmen are voting for legislation written by lobbyists that they haven't even read. Mm-hmm. And it's also clearly documented that congressmen they're not just not reading, they're not even counting the emails that come from their constituents. Congress takes an election as a right to loot. And congressmen are spending 80% of their time raising money in order to be permanently elected. And gerrymandering, which is also addressed by the Electoral Reform Act of 2015, gerrymandering is a form of crime against the public. It's a form of disenfranchising citizens. Most people don't realize that the U.S. government is owned by 42 specific billionaires that provide the bulk of the campaign funding. And they don't realize that 30% of the voting public is the actual active group that votes in a mock election to re-elect people who are essentially criminals.
Right. It's just a tangled web of corruption and voting reform. I love those ideas. It's definitely a major fundamental. Another one is the economic system and the monetary supply. And I heard you mention open money, and you wrote about that a bit in the book. Give us a little bit on that. Can you explain that to the people, what that looks like?
Well, I would rather have them look up open money because this book, The Open Source Everything Manifesto, is a very broad brush tour of the horizon. It's not intended to provide detailed answers on everything. And there are other people far wiser than me that have created open money and Bitcoin and other things. The bottom line here is that open money ends the corrupt privileges of the banks that have been bought from corrupt legislators. For me, open money means that there is no reserve, there are no privileges, there is no escaping the consequences of making a mistake. And beyond that, I would just say, please look up open money and let the originators of open money speak for themselves.
That's fair. And I was going to ask you about Bitcoin, because I was curious if you considered that to be the embodiment of this, or does it kind of fall short as well?
Well, I don't completely understand Bitcoin. I've never been one for encryption. I live my life as an open book NSA. Then, oh, by the way, the good news about NSA is it only processes 1% of what it collects. The bad news is that if you're ever elected senator, it will make sure you know they have every email and every porno photo you ever looked at in their database. So NSA is a blackmail authority, and I actually think highly of Admiral Rogers. I think he has the potential to restore integrity at NSA, which was lost under Mike Hayden and Keith Alexander, both of whom I know personally and both of whom I consider impeachable for treason.
Hmm. Yeah, another question on the subject of the NSA I had for you was about the backdoors into basically every program that's available, every operating system available. These companies build that right in, don't they?
Well, I was one of the people who sounded the alarm on NSA failing to execute its presidentially mandated mission in 1994. It was given the mission of helping make American communications and computing secure against foreign adversaries and against industrial espionage. And at the time, Israel, Germany, and France were the greatest spies on U.S. technology. Not Japan and China, as so many people think. NSA not only refused to do that, but NSA became intellectually and morally lazy. And Senator Boren wrote the foreword to my first book on intelligence, spies, and secrecy in an open world. And in that book, I publicly called for NSA to be required to do its job or to have that job split out. Now, I have to say that all of these back doors in U.S. communications and computing services and products are not NSA's fault. They are the fault of the CEOs of IBM and Dell and Microsoft and other HP. They are the fault of CEOs who violated their fiduciary duties to their stockholders and approved backdoors. And I speak overseas every once in a while. I'm just back from Ecuador. And I will tell you what I told the people in Ecuador. If you buy American communications or computing services or products, you're a moron.
Man.
Now, I would also say that the same is true of Chinese, French, Israeli, and German products and services. So what I'm telling people is they need to build their own trusted open source information technology industry. All proprietary technology, in my view, is not only untrustworthy, it hasn't been properly documented. It should be put in the scrap heap. We need a fresh start.
Oh, I would love that. And you make it sound so possible. It's very inspiring. But there are so many people out there that are afraid of radical change. And I just don't get that, because what about this is worth preserving? Almost anything has got to be an improvement.
I agree with that. And particularly when you look at all of the myths and the malpractice associated with big data. At Phi Beta Iota, there are a couple of trending terms, and one of them is analytics, another one is big data. Most big data is garbage. And people don't realize what big really means. If you have a persistent surveillance device, that's creating 1 terabyte of data every single day. You add 365 days of terabyte data, you end up with a petabyte. Now, you try and send a petabyte across Washington, D.C., it will take you 3 years.
Wow.
With the existing channels. Okay, this is kind of reminds me of the situation in South Africa where they used a carrier pigeon racing against the best broadband that South Africa had and moving some information from one point to another. The carrier pigeon won. I really want to stress this. Do not underestimate the ignorance of agency heads in the U.S. government.
Yeah, that's a key component. And I did want to double back. We talked a little bit about patent and copyright. We had that conversation, and that sort of dovetails into the philosophical debate about media and torrenting and internet piracy, because obviously the major corporations have tried to frame it as stealing, but if I copy it, did I really take anything from you? And philosophically, you know, it's more about access and abundance that rather than corporate profits, but it's going to get even fuzzier when 3D printing becomes more of a thing, wouldn't you say?
Well, there's actually two aspects to this. I just finished uploading most of my books and articles and chapters to academia.edu. Academia.edu is a new service that essentially allows professionals to self-publish and make available to other academics their structured views. Now, I have learned that there is huge value in the previous structuring of information by editors, by corporations. There was a time when it was very important to have peer-reviewed journals and to have structured, paginated, formatted, fact-checked, edited works. And I believe there will always be a place for that as a service. But where it went wrong was in essentially trying to lock that knowledge up. And just the other day, I was helping my son with a paper, and I wanted to go get a reference form, and they were trying to sell me that reference for $30, a 10-page paper for $30. That's criminal. So one of the problems that we have, and again, this is why I'm so upset with Larry Page at Google. One of the problems that we have is that the system we have today is not structured to allow for sense-making and fact-checking. In fact, Stephen E. Arnold, one of the greatest IT analysts I've ever met, has pointed out that Google can't detect false information. The systems that we have today just treat everything at face value, and they're not useful at getting to the cream of the crop. They're not useful at getting to who are the most published things. Now, Twitter and Facebook each have their own kind of potential, but they've also missed major opportunities. I would love to be a strategic advisor to Twitter. I could turn Twitter into the world brain overnight. But not on its present course. So I think that we need to get to where all information is free, but we also need to get to where we pay in fractions of a penny for service value added. For example, I have learned the hard way that my work absolutely desperately needs an editor. And one of the reasons that my most recent book is so good is because my editor, Kathy Green at North Atlantic Books, cut it in half and reduced every word by one syllable. That takes a heroic mind.
Wow, yeah, that takes patience for sure. And I like the idea of large numbers of people paying small amounts for useful services. And that's why I like Bitcoin, because the community really seems to value that aspect. And I do see it as the future. I mean, my whole life has been thrown into that arena where I now have my trust in listeners rather than some corporation waving a check at me that barely provides a living wage. But so many of these ideas that we're talking about, microtransactions, free energy, open money, opening up some patents and technologies, it all seems well overdue, but a lot of it also seems to be in opposition to the capitalistic principles that we run on now. Obviously, making these changes would have huge effects on who makes money and off of what, which I'm fine with. But do you see capitalism and a true open source society coexisting, or is our economic model going to have to do a lot of changing too?
Well, first off, I no longer use the word capitalism, because I think that anything that overemphasizes the financial aspect is inherently corrupt. And I'll point people to my summary of two wonderful books, one by John Bogle, who's a former venture capitalist and banker with a soul. He's written a book on the soul of capitalism. And William Grider, who is a democratic, a progressive author who's written books on the Federal Reserve, Secrets of the Temple, and other books. He's written a book on the soul of capitalism. And the problem here is that labor and land are the two real value-added elements of progress, not money. Money is artificial. Money is an artificial construct that has been used by governments and banks and corporations to essentially screw everybody else. So I have seen a number of economic models. And in fact, let's take open source software as an example. I believe open source software is a calling card. It's basically a proof that you can do something really cool and creative, and then you get hired to essentially build on it and connect it to other things and create new things. There are a number of revenue models that are coming out now for nonprofits, and I'm not a sophisticated person in this area, but I would urge people to look up nonprofit revenue models. And what they will find is that there are many, many ways of making enough money to pay people a good salary and buy the things that you need in order to do the job that you want to do. And most of them don't require that you screw everybody else as part of the deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. There are a lot of fresh ideas in that area. And talking about labor being one of the major resources or the only resource when we think about money, there a lot of people are out there talking about this time banking movement, which is essentially that kind of thing, you know, trading time instead of money or objects.
I like time banking in part because it respects the dignity of every human being.
Yeah, that's a great point. It definitely does. And in a finite life, everybody's time should be valuable.
That's exactly right.
So I love this stuff, man, and I'm very much in favor of radical changes and optimization. It's really exciting to learn about, and I sometimes think about how far it could really be taken. And I think now that the internet has really surpassed the efficiency of libraries and the amount of information in them, and we don't even have to leave the house, but we have these community buildings in every town, and we could really roll out 3D printing studios pretty easy across the nation.
Well, now, hold on there. Let's not go too far. First off...
Is that too far? Did I get crazy?
No. First off, a lot of my son's friends are back from college, and the smarter ones are leaving their cell phones in their rooms and going to the library. The library is a temple for focused intellectual activity, and I absolutely disagree with you on anything that would threaten any library. If anything, we need more libraries.
Fair.
Paul, but let me expand on this. Paul Straussman, one of the greatest minds in our generation, has written a number of books, and one of them was called Information Payoff. And one of the things he explored in Information Payoff was the eye-brain-hand interaction in reading a book. There is a bioneurological process that takes place when you're reading a book that does not happen on screens. And in fact, one of the things we found in military intelligence is that computers make you stupid and they cause you to lose situational awareness. Because back in the day when you had acetate over maps and you were constantly plotting stuff on the map and it was all up on a big board where everybody could see it, you could kind of feel the gestalt of what was going on. You had the feeling in the fingertips. These computer, I've just written a foreword for a book that's coming out soon, which essentially blasts, with the exception of Silo Breaker and Recorded Future, Palantir, i2, all of these so-called analytic toolkits, they're crap. They don't actually do the job. And in fact, when you feed them data, they eat that data and you never see it again. So I think that we're overstating the value of the digital world at this moment in time. We're understating the value of the library. We're also severely understating the value of human conversations and mutual discovery. In my mind, published articles and chapters and books are merely a means for identifying human beings that I want to talk to. And most of the knowledge is going to be generated in conversations creating choices, what Jim Rough, the author of Society's Breakthrough, what Jim Rough calls deliberative dialogue. That's where the knowledge is to be created, in the situation.
Fair. Yeah. I mean, well said. I don't mean to disrespect learning, but the larger point I was trying to make is maybe we should open a wing in these buildings for public 3D printing if the gatekeepers would ever allow it, because that could create such abundance and open up so many doors for people who are living in a lot of debt.
The reality is that Starbucks is going to have 3D printing. You don't need it in a library. You can go into a Starbucks and you can order whatever it is you want created while you have your coffee.
Really? I haven't heard that they were making any strides in 3D printing. They are?
I don't know, but if they aren't, they should be paying attention.
Right, right. All right, and obviously a large part of this is just about creating efficient systems all around. And when you look at the U.S. government, obviously it's grossly overinflated and inefficient. And you've looked at this in great detail. I mean, how much of the national budget would you say is waste? And really, how bad is it?
Well, that's a lovely question. In fact, I haven't been asked that question before, and I would love to see this answer recorded and held for posterity.
Perfect.
First off, one-third of the U.S. government is borrowed money, which is unconstitutional. The U.S. government should not be borrowing money. It should be printing money on the good faith and credit of the U.S. Public treasury and lands. So that borrowed money is not only unconstitutional, it should be grounds for impeachment of everybody that is engaged in approving that borrowed money. Now, as to waste, there have been a number of studies over the years that essentially boil down to 50% waste, whether it's agriculture from the farm to the factory to the supermarket to the family table to the trash bin, 50%. Energy from the original point of creation to the end user, roughly 50%. In the Department of Defense, which is the single largest and most wasteful element of the U.S. government, and it's also the single largest, most wasteful element of discretionary spending in the U.S. government, waste has been documented as 45% in weapons acquisition and 75% in Afghanistan. Hmm. That's from the most recent Inspector General's report. I feel very, very comfortable saying that waste has been documented across every functional area, including diplomacy, including interior, at roughly 50%. Now, if you eliminated the borrowing of the U.S. government, which is something that the two-party tyranny agreed to do in order to basically pay off people, that pays for individual welfare for the Democrats and corporate welfare for the Republicans. If you eliminated that, you're down to a $2 billion budget. Now, if you assume that our $3 billion budget, which is what the U.S. government's budget is each year, $3 billion a year. If you assume it's 50% waste, that takes you down to $1.5 billion, which means you don't actually have to borrow a trillion dollars a year, and you save $500 billion a year.
Wow.
So if you get to, and this is why I want the president to create an open source agency. An open source agency has been approved by the Office of Management and Budget twice now. The first time in the year 2000 by Sean O'Keefe, then deputy director of OMB. The second time by Kathleen Peroff, who was the associate deputy director for national security, in a meeting with Joe Markowitz and myself. Joe is the former head of the Community Open Source Program Office. If the president were to create an open source agency, that would do two things. The first is, for $3 billion a year, it would immediately demonstrate that the secret world is a naked, impotent emperor that should absolutely have its budget cut in half over the next 5 to 6 years. And most of those savings would be against technical programs that don't deliver the return on investment, such as SAIC's Trailblazer for NSA. We would protect the jobs, the people, district by district. That's something I learned watching Senator Warner in 1992. You have to protect the jobs. But where the savings are to be found is in all of the corporate overhead and all of the technical programs that don't actually deliver anything except profits to the corporation. An open source agency would help the president identify and eliminate 30 to 40% waste across every government agency, starting with defense and, of course, among intelligence. The second thing that an open source agency would do is promulgate what OMB calls common solutions. We need to move the entire local, state, and national government structure to open source everything. Open data, open cloud, open data, open hardware, open software, open spectrum. And we need to do that over the next 5 to 6 years.
It's definitely a worthy goal. I would love to see that happen, but it is such an uphill battle. Man, this has been a great show, man. I really appreciate it. So many great ideas. And it is so important to get the information out there to people so they know what they're missing, because they don't even have anything to compare this system to. And by showing the contrast, we just show how off the mark we really are.
That's true. And I mean, I would repeat as we go to wrap up, I would repeat that the primary nonprofit website is earth-intelligence.org. And that's where we'll have the Earth dashboard up in about a week or two. The primary blog is phibetaiota.net. My personal webpage, which is easy to remember and is a pathway to all the others, is robertdavidsteele.com. And last but not least, I will mention that I would love to be hired by the public to really press forward on electoral reform. And the political ideas that I pull together from other people are at bigbatusa.org.
Perfect. Well, that was the last thing I was going to say, is give you an opportunity to wrap up some of those links. So we've done that. But it's been fascinating, man. I'm really excited about getting this out. I think the audience is just going to love it, because this is right up my alley. And there's not a whole lot of people, or at least in this wheelhouse, where we talk about the solutions. We hear a lot about the negatives, a lot about what's wrong. But it's the new ideas that really excite me. So I know I'd vote for you to put those into practice.
Well, I appreciate that. And I will shamelessly admit that I have no salary, no pension, and no savings. So anybody that wants to donate to Earth Intelligence Network, it's a 501c3, and you get a receipt, and the IRS is cool with it. We've received $7,000 in donations this year, and I'd be very, very glad to have some end-of-year donations to pay my next Staples bill.
Awesome. Well, hopefully we can do that for you. Very cool, Rob. I think you are right on the money. I'm a total open sourcer, and I couldn't agree more with that motto of yours, the truth at any cost lowers all costs. I think that's right on the money. So thanks again, and keep doing what you do. All right, man?
Well, thank you, Greg, and I congratulate you on a really excellent interview. Great questions.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm not perfect, but I do what I can.
All right, sir. Bye-bye.
All right. See you later. Thank you. And boom goes the dynamite, people. I hope y'all liked that show as much as I did. Lots of practical information that I think is easier to digest for some of our friends and family that might not be as accepting of some of the deep, dark rabbit hole stuff. Although in the Plus show, we did get heavy with Robert's assessment of Sandy Hook and the Boston bombings, as well as the FEMA camps and the train cars with shackles in them. So don't think we ignored the conspiratorial altogether, but it's really the innovation and ideas for a better world that excite me about this show. And maybe now some of us can have some practical ammunition for the political battles of ignorance that we might find ourselves stuck in during the holidays. In other news, I also got a rare opportunity to try the Lucid Light device that we've heard about a few times, largely from Anthony Peake many moons ago. But you can actually watch the video of that experience on my Facebook. If you want to be friends with me there, feel free. If seeing the activation of my third eye interests you. And other than that, I would just encourage everyone to make the absolute best of the holidays. Lately, I've been talking so much about trying to be better, and I think it's one of the most important things. Don't just be some guy who sits miserably around with a bunch of extended family you don't vibe with. Get in there and help the host with dinner, or spend a little time writing a deep, meaningful card rather than the same old generic stuff. Show up with flowers for your grandma. Help somebody do the dishes at the end of the holiday meal. There's just not enough people rising to the various plethora of occasions out there on both the small everyday scale and the larger level of humanity. And instead of talking about how badly we need to, say, seal the borders or how protesters are wasting their time, turn the conversation into how we need to foster opportunity on the other side of the fence, or how people with concerns should be addressed, not suppressed, regardless of what they are or who they are. We should want a fair, just, and happy life for everyone, not just ourselves. And that's a big takeaway from today's show with Robert. It's about elevating those below us, not isolating ourselves with the idea that immigrants and the poor are going to be clawing at our door. There are better ways, and Robert has convinced me that there's a lot of untapped potential in the 6 billion poor, rather than just a lot of liability, as we're told. I hope you agree, and I hope if we're going to throw stones that we're throwing them up the pyramid, not down. So enjoy yourselves out there. I'm taking off. Expect a very special end of the year extra for Plus members in the next couple of days, and I'll talk to you then. So take care, everybody.
Life is not a spark in space, an episode of Will and Grace. Controversial yet mundane, Deborah's messing with your brain. Even Scientologists know there's more to all of this. Search the ruins for trapdoors, wonder what you're put here for. Simple as a hint of gas, climbing nostrils as you pass. Making Harvard graduates feel childish when they laugh at it. Climb the rungs to kingdom come, sour patch to acid tongue. Are you opposed to having fun? You clench the world between your buns. You could do better, you could do better. You could be the greatest man in the world. You could do better, you could do better. You could be the greatest man in the world. Your life is always the post of something else. Where is the present in the way that you present yourself? And it's disgusting how little that you try. The existential equivalent of pink eye. Drink alone and watch TV. You're expecting harmonies to tap your tune with silver spoons. Anthem of impending doom. Guiding Satan's steady hand. Forcing Beatles to disband. It's ego freaks and drama queens. The young at heart know what I mean. You could